So, hi. I'm going to present a paper that has been submitted to the Journal of Urban Health. They're having a special issue on the public health impact of police violence. And so all of my slides and what I'm talking about come from that paper. So the objectives of my talk are to explain the classical Marxian analysis of racist police violence. So this kind of analysis attempts to actually get at the structural determinants of health and not just the social determinants, and specifically the structural determinants of health, such as racism and the economic system we live under. We're going to discuss this in terms of the history of police violence in Prince George's County, Maryland. We're going to analyze the grassroots opposition to this violence, specifically the People's Coalition for Police Accountability, and we're going to briefly touch on where things are now in Maryland. So the theoretical historical framework of the paper is that racist state violence can best be explained through a classical Marxian analysis. So as Dr. Sam Mitrani describes in his book, The Rise of the Chicago Police Department, Class and Conflict, 1850 to 1894, before the 19th century, there were no police forces that we would recognize as such today. In the northern U.S., there was a system of elected constables and sheriffs, and they were much more responsive to the people that elected them than obviously police forces are today. And in the south, really the only thing you had were slave patrols. Then as the northern cities industrialized, the factories grew, and immigrant working class people moved in. These people were physically and socially separated from the ruling class. And the rich businessmen that ran the municipal governments hired hundreds and then thousands of armed men to keep the working class neighborhoods under control. Class conflict erupted in many late 19th century American cities like Chicago. There were a lot of strikes, there were rebellions and riots, and the police were used to squash all of these with extreme violence. So this is just a short, brief history of police in the U.S., and it is to say that there's never been a time when the police were neutrally enforcing the law. And in fact, the law itself has never really been neutral. As Rich pointed out, you know, it's illegal for anybody to sleep under a bridge, right? But who does that really apply to, right? In summary, the problem of police violence is really only a problem for those at the bottom of the working class. And it's not going to, solving this problem isn't going to be a question of a few bad apples or a few racist cops or sensitivity training. It's really a question of having one group of people maintain control over another group of people. And you can see that this is true because it's not just the police, right? They are backed up by the courts and they are backed up by the politicians. Right? Like the numbers that Malicia presented, you know, you can have all the complaints you want, but if nothing's done about it, okay, it's not just the police then, right? It's other people involved, right? I think that the main thing is that they are used, the police are used disproportionately to affect the people in our society that have the most reason to resent the system, which are disproportionately poor black people. So let me move on to the role of racism under capitalism. I know that, you know, racism, obviously we all know, is a huge problem still in the U.S. today. And it plays itself out in lots of ways, but we're here talking about police violence. The main narrative that explaining racism of white supremacy is, you know, maybe part of it, but I think it really helps to look at who benefits from racism. And from a Marxist standpoint, racism benefits the ruling class of rich businessmen. It keeps workers divided and wages low, and this allows white workers and super exploitation of black workers. And the history of racism is super important to study. I'm obviously not going to cover that here because I just wouldn't have the time to. But there's some great websites that you can find. One of them from the American Anthropological Association has a really nice timeline talking about, you know, kind of where the idea of race came from and how it was propagated through over time in this country. But one of the first times it was used to separate people was after Bacon's Rebellion in the mid-1670s, when white and black indentured servants joined together. After that, laws were made where the black indentured servants became slaves and the white indentured servants were given some modest rewards. And that's when the first time that you see this kind of idea of race being used to divide people. This is not just the idea of leftists like myself, okay? This is a quote from President Lyndon Johnson. I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. Okay, so let's turn to Prince George's County, Maryland. We're going to keep in mind this Marxist framework of racism in the police that I've just described, and let's talk about PG County. So I grew up in PG County my entire life. Just moved to Chicago for residency and stayed here to work. Prince George's County has changed a lot over the last 50 years. It was, the little triangle part of it is D.C., and it's one of the poor counties that surrounds the city. When there was migration of African Americans from the city into the suburbs, a lot of them went to PG County because it was the more affordable white blue-collar community. And over 50 years, it's really changed from being a white blue-collar community to a largely black community. Even though Prince George's County has the distinction of being the wealthiest majority black county in the country, there's still a pretty big socioeconomic divide. So the Beltway, which is the highway that circles D.C. and parts of Maryland and Virginia, inside the Beltway, there's a significantly lower amount of wealth compared to outside the Beltway. And part of that is the function that as white flight moved to the outer edges of the suburb, and also the wealthier African Americans moved outside of there too. This map shows that in 1970, the darker colors are percentage of African Americans, with the darkest being 75 to 100% African American. So this is 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, and 2010. So you can see the county underwent a huge racial demographic shift over the last 50 years. So as this happened, it didn't happen without a lot of struggle and fight and pushback on the ground. There was some racist legislation that was introduced called TRIM, which is basically tax reform initiated by Marylanders. And the goal of this was to cap property taxes and therefore have less public money to spend on public infrastructure such as schools and amenities for the incoming influx of black families. And it was very effective. Now, today in PG County, the schools are still underperforming and there are less amenities than the surrounding counties. There was also a big fight, when it came time to integrate the schools. There was pushback, and the fight back against the racists who wanted to continue segregation was led by the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So that covers the economic changes, but we're going to talk mostly about police violence. Gosh, there's a lot of it, so I'm going to have to move through some of this quickly. Sorry. In the 1960s, PG County had an undercover death squad, which basically was a group of officers that would get like a criminal recruit, and they would have that person lure young black men into committing robberies and then arrest the young black men. So this all went wrong when they ended up shooting and killing two of the men that they had lured into the crime, and actually also shooting their own kind of criminal informant guy. And so that was when the death squad was exposed and they were demobilized. But that wasn't the end of police violence in Prince George's County. From 1972 to 1977, the police shot 56 county residents. And in the paper, there's actually two really great quotes from police officers at that time. I put one of them up there, Nathaniel Austin. He says, PG County still is one of the most racist police departments around. Their reputation is well earned. They deal with blacks and low-income people ruthlessly and brutally. And this was a PG County police officer saying that. So, okay. There were a couple other, there was continual violence, but there were a couple of big cases that really sparked the public outrage. One was the case of Terrence Johnson. One was the case of Gregory Habib. After Gregory Habib's murder, there was a push and there was an establishment of the Citizens Complaint Oversight Panel, maybe kind of similar to the IPRA here in Chicago, where you could take your complaints and then they would review it and then make a suggestion or report to the chief of police. Then there's the case of Archie Elliott III. This is a 23-year-old young man who was pulled over for driving under the influence. He was searched. His hands were handcuffed behind his back, and he was put in the front seat of a police cruiser. And then he was shot 14 times. The police fired 22 times, and 14 bullets struck him, and he was killed instantly. They said that he had somehow pulled a gun on him, even though he wasn't wearing a shirt, and they had just searched him. And his mother, Dorothy Elliott, who is an amazing woman, became the mother of the police accountability movement in PG County. And a lot of the next few bits I'm going to talk about of like what has been done about violence in the county are definitely a large part due to Dorothy. A couple other victims I wanted to mention, because they'll come back later as we talk about this sort of fight back. So in the 1990s, the canine unit of Prince George's County had over 100 bites a year, where they would stick the dogs on 100 people a year. In one of these instances, canine officer Stephanie Moore released her dog to maul two Latino men in Langley Park. In 1999, an unarmed college student was shot in the chest outside of a party. And then in 2000, you guys may have heard of Prince Jones. He was a Howard University student who was followed by a black PG County cop from Prince George's County through D.C. into Virginia, and then murdered by shooting into his vehicle. 16 shots, 8 of them hit him in the back, and he was murdered. So I don't want to not mention the fact that there's a lot of mental health victims, because you know that's what gets talked about when we talk about ways to solve the problem of police violence from a public health perspective, is what can we do for, you know, maybe the mental health piece would be important. And among the 47 residents killed by police in the 90s, 12 of these people were mentally ill, and 7 of these were killed after they had called the police for help, and then the police came and murdered them. And it reminded me a lot, you know, I read this about Stephon Watts, because you know the man who was killed down in Indiana. When his parents called for help. The other interesting thing about this, though, is that so 2/3 of the people that were killed weren't mentally ill. Okay, so dealing with mental health and mental health sensitivity training for officers and better access to mental health is really important for a lot of reasons, but it's not going to solve the problem of police violence. So let's talk about something positive. Rich, maybe you'll like this. Stop being so negative, let's get positive. The People's Coalition for Police Accountability was established in 1999, and it came out of the Enough is Enough campaign. This was a campaign started especially by Dorothy Elliott, the mother of Archie Elliott, but also with a radio show host in D.C., and it was basically saying that, you know, we've had enough of this violence, and the ACLU said, you know, these sporadic demonstrations and fight back, you know, over time are very reactionary, like in reaction to a police murder. Maybe if we had like an actual group that would have some staying power, have some time in the community, we could actually have more of an impact. And so that was where the People's Coalition for Police Accountability came out of. And they meet at the St. Paul's Church in Capitol Heights. So right away, the People's Coalition for Police Accountability got a county council member, Peter Shapiro, interested, and so they expanded the investigative power of the CCOP, which had been established in 1990, and they to investigate way more things than, you know, they had been investigating. And then the PCPA decided on a three-part strategy of educating the community, pushing for progressive legislation to reform the Maryland's Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, or LEOBOR, and engages the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Around the same time this was happening, the Washington Post did a large investigative series on the Prince George's County Police Department, and they reported that from 1990 to 2001, the PG police shot and killed more people per officer than any of the 50 largest law enforcement agencies in the country. They shot 122 people, 45% of them were unarmed. They killed 47 of those people, and 84% of those people that were killed were black. And if you remember the numbers that I put up from 1972 to 1977, where 56 people were shot over a 5-year period, and here we have 122 people shot over a 10-year period, well, you can see the numbers have, nothing's really changed in 20 years in PG County. So let's start with the three-part strategy of the People's Coalition. So strategy one, educate the community. So based on the Washington Post expose, the People's Coalition came up with a Dirty Dozen, which was 12 police officers that were particularly egregious. The Washington Post investigative series pointed out that 20% of the police brutality claims that had happened were a very small group of officers, so kind of repeat offenders, especially egregious crimes. So the People's Coalition for Police Accountability came up with these lists from the investigative series, and decided to, like, you know, publish it and distribute it among members of the community. This was very hotly debated in the PCPA. The idea that you would put out a leaflet with your coalition's name on it, naming individual officers for crimes, was scary to a lot of people. And it took a number of meetings and debating back and forth before people were like, no, we have to do this. People need to know. And there were door-to-door actions giving out this information, as well as demonstrations in response to the continued episodes of police violence. Step two was Leobor reform. So this is the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights. This is for the whole state of Maryland, not just PG County, and it basically was a law enacted in 1974, which gave officers special rights in internal investigations and or disciplinary action. And the People's Coalition for Police Accountability felt that this is basically a codification of the blue wall of silence. It gave officers could decline to talk to their supervisor for 10 days after an incident occurred. Like, they didn't have to answer any questions for 10 days. They still don't. The chief of police has limits on his ability to levy any discipline. The police chief has to actually turn it over to a board, which has historically obviously been very favorable to the police fellow officers. So it's like a board of other police officers instead of your chief of police. And then people that are victimized by the police have to file a complaint within 90 days or nobody cares. So this was all enshrined in law in 1974. So early on in the People's Coalition for Police Accountability, we talked to Delegate Rusher and Baker, a House delegate, and he had sponsored a bill to reform Leobor and maybe take away some of these sort of protections that the police enjoyed, but the bill was never voted out of committee. And then the Department of Justice. So I told you how the K-9 unit during the 1990s was very vicious. So the Department of Justice was actually already investigating the K-9 unit of PG County, but after the murder of Prince Jones and the demonstrations of the Howard University students, and the national attention that was brought to it when Vice President Al Gore went to his funeral and called for a moment of silence on Howard's campus, the Department of Justice decided to expand their investigation for the entire police department and not just the K-9 unit. And then in 2004, the county entered into a memorandum of agreement with the Department of Justice to do a number of overhauls to the way they practice their policing. More cameras, trying to keep better track of the violence, repeat offenders, things like that. And the Department of Justice did keep close eye on PG County over the next 5 years to make sure that they were complying with the memorandum of agreement. So, if any of you have ever worked with community organizations, you know that there are a lot of them. And the People's Coalition for Police Accountability worked with many different community groups. And really, there were a lot of collaborations here for different things. I couldn't actually fit all of them on here, but this is a lot of them. You get the idea that there was a lot of sort of back and forth community work that had to be done to sort of carry off some of these actions and to get things happening. So where are we now in George's County? So the Maryland ACLU reported that from 2010 to 2014, 21 people have died in police encounters in Prince George's County, and the rate at which blacks died by a police encounter was 5 times that of whites. The number of complaints to the Citizen Complaint Oversight Panel has remained relatively stable, and the outcomes of those complaints also remain very stable, which is very, very little is done. Even when the cases where the panel agrees that there was a problem, the police chief only ends up agreeing with them 10%, 20% of the time, depending on the year you look at. As we've seen it everywhere, Ferguson and lots of places, there's been a big militarization of the police force in PG County. Over 2 million pieces of military equipment have been given to the county since 1995, which is the most military equipment of any county in Maryland. And the use of SWAT teams has increased to over 100 times the SWAT team was used in PG County last year. And SWAT teams used to be used only for like really hostile negotiations or things, and now they are used much more routinely. The one bright spot is that Stephanie Moore, the police officer that sticked her dog on those two Latino men in Langley Park, actually did get sentenced for civil rights violations in 2001 and served 8.5 years in jail. And she is the only officer since 1970 ever to be convicted of a crime and sentenced to jail ever since 1970 in PG County. So it's like a one little tiny bright spot and really dark night. Okay.
Were the dogs injured in that process?
The dogs were okay, I think. That was the problem.
That might have been why she got sentenced.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, Selena. How did Stephanie Moore get sentenced and actually go serve jail time? Two of the officers with her that day agreed and testified against her. Were they? I wondered about that too. At least one of them was. I don't remember what the other one was, but probably. Yeah, you're wondering if the sexism is playing a role here. Right, yeah. Yeah. It goes to show, though, however, that, like, unless you have your own fellow officers actually turn on you, right, you're not going to ever get convicted, right, because no one else ever has. So that was the problem for her. So People's Coalition for Police Accountability has been around for 16 years now. They have broadened their approach, so no longer calling themselves People's Coalition for Police Accountability, now just the People's Coalition. When the Trayvon Martin murder happened, and then when Zimmerman was let off, they had a countywide Trayvon Martin support committee, and they've also been working on issues of mass incarceration and on banning the box, kind of getting to what Rich was saying, that maybe if we could remove some of the barriers to employment, then maybe that could make a difference in some of these issues. Because of all of the cases across the country, Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York, Michael Brown in Ferguson, there were more law enforcement related reform measures in the 2015 session of the Maryland legislature. So there are 25 different ones. They were on body cameras, data collection on race-based stops, SWAT usage, reforming LEAVOR again. Only two of these things actually passed, and both of them. And LEAVOR is reform failed yet again. The two that passed, one was on the requirement to collect data on race-based stops by the police, and the other one was on requiring statewide recording of deaths involving law enforcement officers so that maybe we'll have some data, actually. In light of the Baltimore Rebellion, though, which came after this legislative session, there's now a bipartisan working group of Maryland lawmakers who are debating potential police reform measures to be introduced in the 2016 session. So I think that, you know, that seeing the plans of these legislatures suggests that maybe the national people's movement, coupled with the bold response from Baltimore, maybe will lead to a modest legislative reform in the years ahead. So what have we learned? Using the lens of PG County's history of racist police violence over the past 50 years and the community's response to it, we can see the Marxist analysis fits well. The police violence was disproportionately targeted at African American and poor people, and the actual things that came out of it in terms of reforming the police or holding any of them accountable were not held up, and that took the action of not just the police but also of the courts and the politicians' failure to act and failure to prosecute and failure to convict. But consistent work with community organizations can advance consciousness and it can lead to modest legislative changes. And I think that if you look at PG County and think about some of the different reforms that we talked about nationally, you think that maybe those are going to be difficult to achieve and also may not resolve the problem. I may disagree a little bit about whether the cameras are going to make a big difference, considering that we have a number of things that have been videotaped and still people are not being prosecuted. The APHA does have a policy on police violence. It was passed in 1998 when then-President Clinton passed federal legislation to put 100,000 more police officers on the street. And in response, the APHA passed a policy. The action steps were that we should have a collection of statistics on the incidence of police violence, more research on the health consequences and how to prevent police violence, as well as the disproportionate effect on people of color and immigrant populations. We should have independent community-based review boards. We already have that, but in some places, and it's maybe not working, but okay. Strict enforcement of police guidelines and human rights standards with appropriate discipline and criminal charges, full public disclosure of all investigations, and jurisdictions should provide anti-racism training for all law enforcement personnel. So I think that, you know, we could think about maybe updating this policy and taking a firmer stance about police violence, and also, you know, maybe we would have some different action steps now that we've seen how things have changed or not changed over the last 18 years. As one of my friends said when we were talking about this talk this morning, it may be that we don't need another resolution, but a revolution. So think about that. I want to have special thanks to the authors of this paper, Jonathan Hutto and Dr. Green at Howard University in Washington, D.C., who couldn't present the information themselves, but it's been submitted to the Journal of Urban Health Special Issue on the public health impacts of police violence. And they were asked to revise it and resubmit, and that's been resubmitted, so we're waiting to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Selena. The police haven't started coming into the newborn ICU to get our babies yet, but I'm not ruling out anything. What I want to share with you really is going to be very brief and sort of contextualize the presentations that will follow by giving some historical background and show that the shocking things that we see on the evening news or even more shocking things that we see on the internet when we look at the YouTube videos of horrendous things that are going on, these are not new to American culture. So the big context is that this is not just about a few overly violent police officers, but it has to do with maintenance of inequality and maintenance and demonstration of power through the use of violence. Inequality is maintained mostly by ideas, by keeping people divided and segregated from each other, scapegoating certain groups, blaming them for all of the failures of the society. There's also, of course, the judicial use of force, that is to say, locking up incredibly high percentages of African-American population, but really the entire population is incarcerated more than any other country. But we're going to focus today mostly on the extrajudicial use of force, that is, terror applied either by the police or by others and sanctioned by the police. So going to the historical roots, this publication came out in last year, which compiled the thousands of records of lynchings that took place in the United States between the 1880s and the 1960s. Over 4,000, nearly 5,000 lynchings. One statistic that I did not realize until I read through this was that it was not 100% African-Americans. There were large numbers of Mexican and white individuals, especially those who tried to interfere with the lynchings that were going on for minorities. This graph shows that the very beginning of lynchings in the period right after the Civil War, actually getting the whites in line was actually predominant. Notice the blue line is higher. But from around the turn of the 20th century onward, it was heavily dominated by African Americans being murdered in this manner. The peak years got to around 160 deaths per year. Now, fast forward to the present. When I tried to research this topic a couple of years ago, there was really no complete data set at all about who the police were killing in America. And it was a British newspaper that set up this website. The Guardian set up a website that they call The Counted, which gets updated each day. And as a matter of fact, from when we started looking at that a week ago until Saturday, you see that the numbers went up from 928 to 957 just in this last week. Both the major media-sponsored counts, the one by The Guardian, another one that's done by The Washington Post, are similar in their counts. So this is not way off order of magnitude misestimates. These are roughly similar. And the United States government, which obviously should be collecting this, has not been. 22% of all people killed by the police were unarmed, but interestingly, two-thirds of the unarmed people killed by the police were black or Latino. Perhaps embarrassed by The Guardian's revelations, the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch — you couldn't have made that up, could you? That last name. Loretta Lynch announced just a couple of weeks ago that the federal government is now going to maintain a public database as well. So the earlier state-sanctioned killing, that is lynching, did reach mass proportions. However, today's state-sanctioned killing is much more than 10 times as much. In both periods, killing involved various racial groups and ethnic groups, but it's always been a very, very racist phenomenon. It's interesting that if we come up with 70-something percent of the deaths being African Americans, I would say virtually 100% of the prominent media coverage is African Americans. Just to put this in perspective for other forms of death by violence that impact our culture, so if you go back to the previous century, the lynching deaths in the highest year, this is not the average, this is the peak year when they had 160, is roughly equal to the number of deaths per year since the United States invaded Afghanistan. Police killings are closer to 1,200. So this is to contextualize this in terms of the scope of the problem. This is a very big problem. It involves a lot of loss of life and has not been addressed systematically by our government or even by our research organizations. However, interestingly, after people rebelled in Ferguson, Missouri, and then another rebellion broke out following the horrendous death that took place in Baltimore, all of a sudden, media and other mainstream institutions became much more interested. It was after that that the Guardian set up their counting website, and it's after the Guardian that the federal government did it. So we should think about what does it mean when people talk about violence. Clearly, this is very violent. This is not keeping the peace, which is the terminology often used in media accounts of police killings. And rebels in Ferguson light a building on fire with no one inside the building, and that is referred to as violence. So I'm going to stop here and let my colleagues talk more about different approaches that have been taken to dealing with this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. David. Next on our panel, Mr. Richard Wallace. He is with Summit Executives, Men and Women in Prison Ministries, and he's also a field organizing director at the Workers Center for Racial Justice. That's cool.
All right. So I don't have any nifty slides, and I'm not going to make y'all depressed, because this is some depressing stuff, right? It's like we see it on the news every day. We're like, oh my God, here we go again. Here we go again. Here we go again. And my goal and my point of being on this panel today is discuss how this links to unemployment. I'm just going to read two statistics to you, and then you can go and kind of think about it as I present. But 92% of black males aged 16 and 19 are unemployed. That was a statistic that came out in 2012. African-American males aged 17 to 25 make up the greatest percentage of Chicago homicide victims. And that came out in 2014. So seeing the demographics, the parallel, unemployment, police violence, et cetera, you know, murder victims, all within the same category. So it's almost as if, like, if you think about it, employment is not going to cure police violence or stop people from being killed, but it will increase the probability that that person or that individual will not be engaged in other forms of economic, right, underground economics, et cetera, et cetera. So my job as a worker center organizer is I go out and I talk to the people that are on the streets, and I find out from them what are some of the problems that they're facing. Of course, police violence is one of the things that they talk about. One of the most pressing issues is access to employment. A number of the brothers that I deal with are post-incarcerated. They've been to jail once or twice before. They get out and they in turn have to enter something we call the underground economic system in Chicago, right, which is drug trade. And oftentimes people think drug trade is the only form of underground economics, but there's multiple forms, right? There's sex trade, drug trade, you know, people buy and sell things for, there's bootleg DVDs, right? Like there's a number of forms of like underground economy that exists in Chicago that a number of our members actually go into because they are forced out of the mainstream economy in the United States, right? So, and there's multiple ways that that's happened over time. And from its inception, labor has been a fight between two classes, the owners — I'm not going to get too Marxist on y'all — but the owners of the means of production, right, and then the workers, right? You have to — I think the interesting thing is in the United States is that, like, if you really want to see someone get locked up, buy a cow and try to sell milk door to door. That person will get locked up quicker than a dope man. I'm being honest with you, because in the United States, you have to be able to sell, like, you have to be able to sell your labor in order to get a wage, right? I go to work, I get a wage. I take that wage, I go to a grocery store, I buy my vegetables, my fruit, my whatever, I pay for my gas, my light, I have housing, I pay for my water, etc. I have to exchange this wage in order to survive, right? I have to work in order to survive. If you deny people access to employment, you are demanding that they die, right? Either die, but die peacefully, right? Don't act up and die, right? Die peacefully, right? Die quietly, die silently, right? So until we start identifying how this economic piece, right, employment, right, which is essential in our economic system, right, you have to have a wage in order to survive. It's really simple. You have to have money to buy food to survive, right? So when you see people form these underground economies, it's out of — not, it's a last resort. It's not a priority. It's not like, well, I'm just going to decide to, you know, delve into sex trade and drug trade for a couple days. Like, most of the guys I know are like, I would rather work a 9-to-5 like my grandfather did than to do what I'm doing right now. But they have no other access points to employment, right? And employment is life, right? So they have to provide for themselves. So I cannot tell this person, this young woman — I used to work in public health too, and we used to have a lot of women and men that came in that engaged in sex trafficking, right, and commercial sex trade. I cannot tell that person to stop doing that. It's not within my right to tell that person, you better not. I can say, use condoms, use protection, be safe, right? But I cannot tell you what you can do in order to acquire subsistence to provide for your life, right? I can't say, unless I can offer you my job, right? You know what, stop doing that, take my job, I quit. But that isn't an option, right? So what I have to do is be like, okay, well, this is the safest way to do that, right? And then knock on doors and go to some of these factories around here and try to get jobs for the folks in the community. And that's basically what I do as an organizer. I go to work, door to different factories, we identify where there is employment, there is access points. But the Industrial Revolution that took place in the past, that era is over, right? There isn't those manufacturing jobs that existed back in during the New Deal era, right? And people were the development of the middle class, that time period that a lot of us have came from, right? Those jobs aren't available, right? So you see the fight for 15, you think, oh man, these people, you shouldn't get $15 to flip burgers at McDonald's, right? People say that. I've heard that conversation many times. But I say, where else is the working class going to get employed, right? Where are the factory jobs that built Detroit, Gary, Indiana, et cetera, et cetera? And you don't see those factory jobs really available anymore. So what we have is this replicated process of people getting out of prison, right, entering into the underground economy. But a lot of these brothers try 6, 7, 8 months to try to get jobs, put an application in, and then get denied. And then you got a family, you got to provide for your family. Wife, like, you ain't doing that. You're supposed to provide. I mean, I've had that conversation happen. And what ends up happening is that those brothers enter back into the underground economy because they have to in order to survive. And they end up back in jail and they come back out. It's the same process. So, what I want to talk about is solutions to that, like solutions to the economic problem, solutions to the lack of employment in Chicago, solutions to police violence, right? And that violence is always just like — the economic violence is not as prevalent, right? We don't talk about economic violence, right? Like the fact that 750,000 African Americans have been displaced from the city of Chicago, that's economic violence, right? If you don't have to say no black people allowed, right? You don't have to say that, but you can say this coffee is $12. Right, and that's saying like no poor people allowed. Right, this condo is $350,000. Right, That's not saying no black people, no poor people allowed. That's just saying that you can't live here unless you have $350,000. We're not racist, right? Right? We're not classist. We're just, you know, we're gentrifying, right? So we have to talk about how those practices that have come into play over the last, the last 100 years, right? The expansion of neoliberalism, right? How that is affecting and creating the problems that we see on the street, and tying those issues to Ferguson, to Rekia Boyd, tying those issues to Sandra Bland, tying those issues to Black Lives Matter, right? The economic problem is one of the most major problems that is pressing America. And it's unifying across the board. I've seen white folks in Janesville, Wisconsin without employment after GM plants shut down, right? So access to employment is causing people to starve. And when people starve, they make rasher decisions in order to provide for themselves. So that's my piece. We'll talk more about that later, but that's it.
Thank you, Richard. I was glad you mentioned the Sandra Bland and the Ferguson and the Mike Browns, you know, the Eric Gardners of the world. It's really disheartening as a public health or professional to sit back and listen to the media talk about the violence that has occurred because the people that are supposed to serve and protect us have found a way to not necessarily serve or protect us. And to hear your young African-American males say, when you tell them, you talk about college readiness, and they look at you like, what? College who? I just want to make it to tomorrow. And it's not necessarily violence that's perpetrated within the neighborhood, but they don't know who may come along and take their lives. So at some point in time, we have to say something, or more instead of even saying it, we have to do something differently, because violence impacts health, regardless as to who perpetrates it. Whenever something happens to you where it affects the longevity of life or quality of life, then you have to look at it through a different lens. And many people are not talking about it in the way that they should, because these are positions of power, regardless as to what color you are. As we all saw, Sandra Bland was a woman, she was getting ready to go to work. We are talking about young black girls in classrooms that are being handled as if they are on the wrestling mat. And it's okay to somebody. So that was just my little spiel. Next on our panel, Ms. Melisha Bonza. I met Melisha some years ago. She came in my office wanting to attend the School of Public Health. And all I said to her was, you can do whatever you want to do. And she applied, got accepted, and graduated. So she's a recent grad from the UIC School of Public Health with her master's degree in health policy administration. She is currently the Director of Community Outreach and Provider Relations for the UIC Department of Pediatrics CHECK program. Ms. Bonds is also a minister, and she has a true heart and love for people. Melisha.
Thank you very much, Ms. Delina. I just have to acknowledge my mother that's in the room, my pastor. I gotta always do that, no matter where I go. You gotta give honor to where you came from. Wonderful. I don't want to hear it when I leave the session, so I don't want to get show. But thank you all. Appreciate that. And of course, honor God, of course. But I just want to say, as I'm getting into this presentation, is that, you know, I've gone through about three different titles of this presentation. Being a young African American woman, you know, wondering why every time a police car passes me, why do I tense up? Why do I get scared? Even though I know I'm not doing wrong, but immediately I feel this sense of anxiety that comes over me, even though I'm a law-abiding citizen, and you know, and I'm a good person, and you know, I was raised with good morals and standards. Why is it that when a police officer car passes me, why do I tense up? And that's something that began to dwell on my mind when I came into the School of Public Health. So this presentation has gone through several titles. First, I called it Hunting Season because I felt that African Americans were being hunted by the police as if we were cattle. Then I called it Police Use of Excessive Force. And then just yesterday I was talking to Selena and I forgot to update the title slide, but it came to me. It should be called Let's Do Away with All the He Say, She Say and Hold the Police Accountable. And what I mean by the he say, she say, I mean that it's just their word versus our word, or their word versus the innocent victims that have lost their lives as a result of inaccurate investigations. So keep that in your mind. Let's do away with all the he say, she say, because I forgot to update the slide. Okay. So this presentation also came as a result of me starting to do some exploratory work on trying to understand police brutality. You know, I know when I see a police car, I know I get upset. When I see issues of police brutality, I know I get upset. But what can we really do about it? You know, the African American population has been notorious throughout the Jim Crow, through Martin Luther King era, Malcolm X era, of the rallies. You know, I'm so fired up with rallies that I went and joined the Occupy movement, and I decided that I was going to go to every rally that they had on police misconduct. But I thought to myself, we've got to have something to go along with those rallies, because rallies can get pretty exhausting. You know, you go to so many churches, so many community events, you stand on so many corners, you walk down so many streets. Where are the policies that are actually backing up the people that are exhausted from rallying? So the problem statement that I came up with was, what can the city of Chicago do to decrease the rates of police use of excessive force in the Chicagoland area? So this actually complements what Dr. David was talking about within his research. So here we were looking at police misconduct cases. And I was trying to see in the year 2010 this graph that I received from the National Police Misconduct Statistics and Reporting Report was talking about the amount of money that had been spent in settling cases or lawsuits in 2010 from police misconduct. I don't have to read the numbers, you can see it for yourself. The amount of money that is costing us, and the data needs to be updated, but the data from these particular years is still true, it will still happen. I will be doing more research updating the slides, but I definitely wanted to share data that I had come across so far during my time in the School of Public Health. We're spending tons of money on cases of police misconduct, of people, lawsuits. And we have a lot of barriers. And we've got health disparities, we've got the governor closing down programs, all types of stuff. And look at the amount of money that we're spending just in this area alone that could be saved and put to use for actually helping, you know, combat some of the disparities that African American and other racial ethnic groups are actually encountering. So I was looking at some data from the Independent Police Review Authority, IPRA, annual report from 2010 to 2012. And it says here that the number of police officers against whom an allegation of unreasonable force was made was 531. I'm reading it because I don't know if some of you can see it in the back. It's a little bit, it's not too clear of a slide, but the number of allegations of unreasonable force made against all accused officers was 580. The number of police officers against whom disciplinary charges were filed on the basis of allegations of unreasonable force was 11. So you gotta ask yourself, you mean to tell me, you know, that all of the people, or the majority of the people that reported these cases, they just made it up. They just lied. It was just fabricated. That only 11 cases of police use of excessive force with police officers against whom disciplinary charges were filed. And then it says the listing of investigations of allegations of reasonable force pending as of the date of this report, together with dates on which such allegations were made, was 498. So you mean to tell me that with all of the knowledge that we have with the different, you know, Chicago police departments and other, you know, law enforcement departments, that we don't have the expertise to properly investigate 498 cases? And I'm sure there's probably more than that. This is just a point in time that this data represents. The listing of allegations of a reasonable force for which the board has determined not to file charges was 675. Who are the people that are actually on these boards that are actually looking into these cases for investigations? So then I went down to look at more data, and it's a little bit unclear, so I'm going to read it. But that in 2010 and 2012, there were 1,281 reports of excessive force. So it says that these are the primary, thank you, I just need to take a quick water break. Thanks, appreciate that. There was 1,281 cases of excessive force. And then, so basically this is saying that there's domestic violence, there's verbal abuse, there's coercion, there's shooting with hits, there's shooting with no hits. Some of it is a little bit unclear, but essentially what this is saying, that out of all of the cases that reported, excessive force was the top widely most reported type of, you know, issues to the Chicago Police Department. And then it said that in 2011 to 2012, it increased. So I just, you know, this starts to just really bubble my passion about, you know, what are we doing about this in terms of policy? So I wish my professor was here to hear this. She'd be so proud. But one of the things she educated us on was, what are the market failures that, you know, have to do with this particular issue that's going on? Some of it is market failure. It's the vulnerable individuals not being protected. Individuals become victimized by the Chicago Police Department. The other one is imperfect information. Not all use of excessive force reported is being prosecuted. And then next was negative externalities. People of the community lose trust in the police, i.e. myself. Why do I feel tense when a police car drives past me when I know I'm not breaking the law? It's the neighborhood cooperation with law enforcement is negatively impacted, to the point where if police officers are supposed to be sworn in to protect civilians, why then are community inhabitants scared of the police? Now, don't get me wrong. I know a lot of great police officers. I'm not up here to bash police officers. I know a lot of great ones. They've done a lot of community work. We have several community outreach programs where the police come out there. They help. I've had friends that have, you know, had testimonies how the police pretty much saved their life. I'm not up here to talk about that. I'm up here just to talk about the fact that lives are being lost and people are being physically harmed by the inconsistencies in the system. So I just wanted to give that disclaimer. The government failures that some of which I started to identify in my readings is that currently the city of Chicago relies heavily on the narratives of the Fraternal Order of Chicago Police. As a result, many cases go without being prosecuted. So this is where I got the let's do away with the he say, she say. The next point was that rules are too broad. Current city of Chicago ordinances do not make mention of the term excessive force regarding police misconduct. Now, that was the case at the time that I pulled this information. The rules are too arbitrary. The same rules that would deem prosecution don't always apply to every reported case. It's a case-by-case scenario, and people lose faith in the government system. You have people that have issues, and they don't even report it because they feel like, what's the point? There's not going to be any help for me. There's not going to be any justice for me. People feel like there's no help. You know, the Superman cartoon don't come to life for these people. So they're wondering, what do they do? It's a sense of frustration. The next is just like I was looking at different policy alternatives with the current status quo. Incentivizing and awarding Chicago police districts that have low reports of police use of excessive force. So maybe if we give some awards to them, maybe if they think they're going to get some monetary, you know, incentives, maybe that will help people to stay more in line. Then also, I came up with mandating Chicago police to be armed with body cameras to monitor police behavior. And then lastly, I came up with fund evidence-based police use of excessive force prevention and intervention training programs. So the criterion that I used to kind of rate these options was targeted impact, justice for victims, cost saving, cost of implementation, acceptability, and political feasibility. Some of the stakeholders, obviously, that we would rely on would be the U.S. Department of Justice, our governors, legislators, City of Chicago Council members, Chicago Police Department, police oversight groups, civilian review boards, civilian and human rights organizations, newspaper, television, etc. So when I began to sort of put these in a side-by-side analysis to kind of rate, what should be the method or the approach that we should take or at least begin to think about as we're trying to brainstorm together in a collaborative effort on what we can do. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I have all the answers. I'm just saying that these are some really good points of where we could start from. And what I came up with is that using police body cameras, to me, had the highest rating. Now, I got that because I read an article in that was published on August 21st, 2013 in the New York Times. In the state of California, in the first year after the cameras were introduced, in February 2012, the number of complaints filed against officers fell by 88%. This is really why I did this whole presentation, everyone. I will just repeat that for you one more time. Let me know if I'm going over time, okay? In the first year after the cameras were introduced here in February 2012, the number of complaints filed against officers fell by 88% compared with the previous 12 months. Use of force by officers fell by almost 60% in the same period. And then it later said that starting September 1st of 2012, all 66 uniformed officers in California for this particular precinct will be wearing a camera during every shift. So if California has jumped on the bandwagon, why can't Chicago? Why can't we start to use these sorts of innovative, if we really care about the people and the inhabitants of this community, and the police and other law enforcement say that, you know, those people just breaking the law, let's do away with the he say, she say. Let's put some cameras out there on police officers. And essentially the way that it worked, the way that the article described it in full, can't read it word for word due to time, but the officer actually has these glasses. Now, certainly, it can be worn maybe in a badge, but this particular example, the police officers in California, they wear these glasses. And before they even engage in conversation, the first thing they let the people know during routine traffic stops or stopping other people that may be perceived as breaking the law is, let me let you know, you're being recorded and I'm being recorded. So not only does this protect people from any fabrication of, you know, one way of helping to protect people from fabrication of evidence, but it also protects the police officers so that we can see what really happened. So when you go to court and a jury's trying to deliberate, they should be able to use this in the deliberation room about what actually occurred, and they can see it for themselves, not just a bunch of he say, she say, and written reports. Let's see what actually took place, and then let the decision in the information, visual information, speak for itself. So the key takeaways from it is that learning what market and government failures are, learning how to develop criterion that will address my problem most effectively, this is what I learned. Learning how to cite correctly, my professor would be proud. And the importance of research and policy analytical skills and preparing how to effectively articulate our problem. Now, the main reason why I did this also was because of the story of Howard Morgan. I don't know if any of you all heard of the story of Howard Morgan, but this particular case was about the story of a police officer that was shot 28 times by four white CPDs. After they shot him, they cut him, they beat him, they put his body in a black bag, and they thought he was dead. They took his body down to Mount Sinai only to find out that he, only by God's grace, that's why I'm a believer, he wiggled his toe. Unlike the other cases of police brutality, Rekia Boyd, young lady who was shot in the head by an off-duty cop, Stephon Watts, young boy with mental health challenges that was killed in his house, and Trayvon Martin, all cases we know, as well as all the cases that Dr. David mentioned in his presentation, Howard Morgan is still alive. He's still alive to tell his story on how police use of excessive force left him with 28 bullet holes in his body. It left him after the police shot him. They then destroyed the crime scene, ballistics and everything. He was then tried and accused of four counts of attempted first-degree murder, one count of aggravated discharge, and one count of aggravated battery, and one count of unlawful discharge of a firearm. Why then was he almost sentenced to life in prison due to consecutive sentences if this incident happened at the time when he was in his 50s? You really have to wonder, what would have happened if the police in this case had on the glasses? Howard Morgan wouldn't have had to not only get shot up, cut, humiliated, pension taken, character, defamation of character, family, time from his family taken. I know because he's my uncle. Police brutality is affecting many lives here. And if we can't come together as an academic and research professional group to come together and actually not only create policies, but not be afraid to talk about the policies that are needed to shed light on these disparities, then what are we here for? So I leave you with this. Let's do away with the he say, she say, and let's start visually showing, because the evidence will speak for itself. Thank you.